23-year-old Edward Winslow. In 1618, Brewster and Winslow published a religious tract critical of the English king and his bishops. James ordered Brewster's arrest, and when the king's agents in Holland came to seize the pilgrim elder, Brewster was forced into hiding just as preparations to depart for America entered the most critical phase. Brewster was the only pilgrim with political and diplomatic experience. As a young man, he had served as an assistant to Queen Elizabeth's Secretary of State, William Davison. Brewster's budding diplomatic career had been cut short when the Queen had used Davison as her scapegoat for the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. With his mentor in prison, Brewster had been forced to return home to Scrooby, where he had taken over his father's position as postmaster. In addition to having once been familiar with the highest levels of political power, Brewster possessed an unusually empathetic nature. He was tender-hearted and compassionate of such as were in misery, Bradford wrote, but especially of such as had been of good estate and rank and were fallen unto want and poverty. More than anyone else, with the possible exception of Pastor Robinson, Elder Brewster was the person upon whom the congregation depended for guidance and support. But as they wrestled with the myriad details of planning a voyage to America, Brewster was, at least for now, lost to them. By the beginning of the 17th century, it had become apparent that the colonization of North America was essential to England's future prosperity. France, Holland, and especially Spain had already taken advantage of the seemingly limitless resources of the New World. But the British government lacked the financial wherewithal to fund a broad-based colonization effort of its own. Seeing it as an opportunity to add to their already considerable personal wealth, two groups of noblemen, one based in London, the other to the west in Plymouth, were eager to underwrite British settlements in America. And in 1606, James created the Virginia Company. But after the Plymouth group's attempts to found a colony in modern Maine failed miserably, and Jamestown proved to be something less than a financial success, the two branches of the Virginia Company realized that they too lacked the resources required to colonize America. They then resolved to franchise future settlements by issuing subsidiary or particular patents to those interested in beginning a plantation. These conditional patents gave the settlers the right to attempt to found a colony in 5 to 7 years' time, after which they could apply for a new patent that gave them permanent title to the land. With Brewster in hiding, the pilgrims looked to their deacon John Carver, probably in his mid-30s, and Robert Cushman, 41, to carry on negotiations with the appropriate officials in London. By June 1619, Carver and Cushman had succeeded in securing a patent from the Virginia Company, but the pilgrims' plans were still far from complete. They had a patent, but had not as of yet figured out how they were going to finance the endeavor. But William Bradford's faith in the undertaking was so strong that he sold his house in the spring of 1619. Soon after, disturbing news came from London. Robert Cushman reported that a group very similar to their own had recently met with disaster on a voyage to America. Led by a Mr. Blackwell, 180 English separatists from Emden, Holland, had sailed that winter for Virginia. By the time the ship reached America, 130 of the emigrants, including Blackwell, were dead. "They were packed together like herrings," Cushman wrote. "They had amongst them the flux and also want of fresh water. So as it is here rather wondered at, that so many are alive, then so many are dead." Still, the news was deeply troubling to those in Leiden, and many of them began to have second thoughts about sailing to America. Even Cushman had to admit that he, a grocer and woolcomber originally from Canterbury, felt overwhelmed by the challenges and responsibilities of organizing the voyage. "It doth often trouble me," he wrote, "to think that in this business we are all to learn and none to teach." About this time, some representatives from Holland, having heard of the pilgrims' intention to relocate to America, made them fair offers concerning a possible settlement. But the pilgrims declined. It would have been impossible to reassert their English identity in a Dutch colony. What they do not seem to have taken into account was the possible danger of spurning this particular overture. The Dutch, still several years from founding a colony at Manhattan, appear to have begun to work covertly to block the Pilgrims' subsequent attempts to settle in this strategic location. Instead of looking to Holland, the Pilgrims threw in their lot with a smooth-talking merchant from London named Thomas Weston. Weston represented a group of investors known as the Merchant Adventurers, about 70 London merchants who viewed the colonization of America as both an investment opportunity and a way to plant religion. Most of them appear to have shared Puritan spiritual leanings, although some were clearly wary of the radicalism of the Pilgrims' separatist beliefs. Even though the Pilgrims had secured a patent the year before, the merchant adventurers obtained a patent of their own for a settlement in the northern portion of Virginia at the mouth of the Hudson River. In the beginning, Weston seemed a godsend, a man sympathetic to their religious goals, who also claimed to have the financial wherewithal to make their cherished dreams a reality. Weston proposed that they enter into a joint stock company. The adventurers would put up most of the capital with the expectation that once they were settled in America, the Pilgrims would quickly begin to generate considerable profits, primarily through cod fishing and the fur trade. The Pilgrims would each be given a share in the company valued at £10. For the next 7 years, they would work 4 days a week for the company and 2 days a week for themselves, with the Sabbath reserved for worship. At the end of the 7 years, the capital and profits would be divided among all of them, with the Pilgrims owning their houses and home lots free and clear. As the spring of 1620 approached, many had decided to wait until those in the first brunt had cleared the way for them. Still others, such as Bradford, had already sold their homes and had long since been ready to depart. A census of the congregation revealed that only about 125 people, a third of their total number, would be departing for the New World, with the rest to follow soon after. Pastor Robinson, it was decided, would stay for now in Leiden with the majority of his flock, with Elder Brewster attending to the religious needs of those in America. As the Pilgrims prepared to depart in the spring of 1620, Weston's true nature began to reveal itself. He now claimed that circumstances had changed, making it necessary to adjust the original agreement. He had hoped to secure a fishing monopoly for the settlement, but it was now clear that this was not possible. Many of his fellow adventurers, he maintained, were inclined to back out. If the merchants in London were to come forward with the necessary funds, the Pilgrims must agree to dedicate all their time to working for the company. Instead of having 2 days a week for themselves, they must spend every minute laboring for the adventurers. Robinson and the Pilgrims in Leiden vehemently objected, claiming that the new terms were fitter for thieves and bond slaves than honest men. Making matters all the worse was that Robert Cushman had agreed to Weston's new terms without consulting the rest of them back in Leiden. In June, they discovered that, incredibly, Weston had not yet arranged any transportation to America. If they had any hope of reaching the mouth of the Hudson River before winter, they must depart as soon as possible. While Weston hunted up a ship in London, the Pilgrims decided to purchase a small sailing vessel of their own in Holland. Not only would it be used to transport some of them across the Atlantic, it would be useful for both fishing and exploring the coast once they were in America. And if the worst should happen, it would provide a means for the survivors to return to England. Adding to the Pilgrims' growing sense of alarm was the fact that the adventurers had insisted on adding some non-separatists from London to the mix. Some had strong ties to the group in Leiden, but others were completely unknown to them. How they would get along with these strangers was of deep concern, especially since one of them, a man named Christopher Martin, was already proving to be a most difficult personality. The adventurers designated Martin as a purchasing agent, and he, along with Cushman and Carver, began to secure supplies and provisions, beer, wine, hardtack, salted beef and pork, dried peas, fishing supplies, muskets, armor, clothing, tools, trade goods for the Indians, and the screwjack that would come in handy even before they reached America. Martin, a haughty and willful man, refused to coordinate his efforts with Carver and Cushman. While the Pilgrim agents collected provisions in London and Canterbury, Martin proceeded to do as he pleased in Southampton, a major port in the south of England. Soon, no one really knew where matters stood when it came to provisions. "We are readier to dispute than to set forward a voyage," Cushman lamented on June 10th. Despite the chaotic and acrimonious nature of the preparations in England, the Pilgrims in Leiden forged ahead, purchasing a 60-ton vessel named the Speedwell. Less than 50 feet in length, she was considered large enough for a voyage across the Atlantic. Earlier expeditions had successfully completed the crossing in vessels that were less than half the Speedwell's tonnage. The Pilgrims hired a master and crew who agreed to stay on for at least a year in America and who undoubtedly oversaw the fitting out of the vessel with two new and larger masts. The refitting of the Speedwell may have seemed like an insignificant matter at the time. As it turned out, however, this misnamed vessel and her master, known to us only as Mr. Reynolds, would have a disastrous impact on the voyage ahead. By the end of July, the Pilgrims, accompanied by a large number of family and friends, had made their way to Delfshaven, the small Dutch port where the Speedwell was waiting. The plan was to sail for Southampton, where they would rendezvous with whatever ship Weston had secured in London. "They went aboard, and their friends with them," Bradford wrote, "where truly doleful was the sight of that sad and mournful parting, to see what sighs and sobs and prayers did sound amongst them, what tears did gush from every eye, and pithy speeches pierced each heart." For Bradford and his wife Dorothy, the parting in Delfshaven was particularly painful. They had decided to leave their 3-year-old son, John, behind in Holland, perhaps with Dorothy's parents in Amsterdam. It was certainly safer for the child, but the emotional cost, especially for the boy's mother, would become increasingly difficult to bear. Whether he realized it or not, Bradford was inflicting his own childhood experience on his son. For a time, at least, John would be, for all intents and purposes, an orphan. When the tide turned in their favor, it was time to depart. Pastor Robinson fell down to his knees on the Speedwell's deck, as did everyone present, and, with watery cheeks, commended them with most fervent prayers to the Lord and his blessing. It was a remarkable display of such love as indeed is seldom found on earth. Years later, the residents of Delfshaven were still talking about the departure of the Pilgrims in July 1620. By the time the Leideners departed from Delfshaven, Weston had hired an old and reliable ship named the Mayflower, which, after taking aboard passengers in London, sailed to Southampton to rendezvous with the Speedwell. Southampton was an ancient English port encircled by a medieval stone wall, and near the west gate of Southampton, the Leiden contingent got their first glimpse of the ship that was to sail with them to America. The Mayflower was a typical merchant vessel of her day, square-rigged and beak-bowed, with high, castle-like superstructures fore and aft that protected her cargo and crew in the worst weather but made beating against the wind a painfully inefficient endeavor. Rated at 180 tons, meaning that her hold was capable of accommodating 180 casks or tons of wine, she was approximately 3 times the size of the Speedwell and about 100 feet in length. The Mayflower's commanding officer, known as the Master, was Christopher Jones. About 50 years old, he was also a part owner of the ship. Records indicate that Jones had been master of the Mayflower for the last 11 years, sailing back and forth across the Channel with English woolens to France and returning to London with French wine. Wine ships, such as the Mayflower, were known as sweet ships, since the inevitable spillage of the acetic wine helped to temper the stench of the bilge. In addition to wine and wool, Jones had transported hats, hemp, Spanish salt, hops, and vinegar to Norway, and may even have taken the Mayflower on a whaling voyage to Greenland. He and his wife, Josian, had had 5 children, and although he had no way of knowing it at the time, Josian was pregnant with another son, who would be born at their home in Rotherhithe, just down the Thames from London, the following March. Serving as Jones's mate and pilot was Robert Coppin, who, unlike Jones, had been to America before. Also serving as pilot was John Clark, 45, who delivered some cattle to Jamestown the previous year. Giles Heal was the ship's surgeon. In the days ahead, as sickness spread through the passengers and crew, he would become one of the most sought-after officers of the Mayflower. Another important position was that of the cooper, who was in charge of maintaining all barreled supplies and provisions. In Southampton, Jones secured the 21-year-old cooper, John Alden, who, because of his youth and skills, was already being encouraged by the Pilgrims to remain in America at the completion of the crossing. In addition, there were somewhere between 20 and 30 sailors whose names have not survived. In Southampton, the Leideners met up with the family and friends who had first boarded the Mayflower in London and would be continuing on with them to America. Most shared their religious beliefs, and several of them were actual members of the Leiden congregation. The most notable of the group was Elder William Brewster, who had been hiding out in Holland and perhaps even England for the last year. The return of Brewster, the highest-ranking layperson of the congregation and their designated spiritual leader in the New World, must have been as emotionally charged as their departure from Leiden. Also joining them in Southampton were Robert Cushman and John Carver, who was traveling with his wife, Catherine, and 5 servants. Although not a member of the congregation, Captain Miles Standish was well known to the Leideners. Standish, who was accompanied by his wife, Rose, and may or may not have come over on the Speedwell, had served as an English mercenary in Holland and would be handling the colony's military matters in America. It was in Southampton that they met the so-called strangers, passengers recruited by the adventurers to take the places of those who had chosen to remain in Holland. Besides the domineering Christopher Martin, who had been designated the governor of the Mayflower by the adventurers and was traveling with his wife and 2 servants, there were 4 additional families. Stephen Hopkins was making his 2nd trip to America. 11 years earlier, in 1609, he had sailed on the Sea Venture for Virginia, only to become shipwrecked in Bermuda, an incident that became the basis for Shakespeare's The Tempest. While on Bermuda, Hopkins had been part of an attempted mutiny and been sentenced to hang, but pleading tearfully for his life, he was, at the last minute, given a reprieve. Hopkins spent 2 years in Jamestown before returning to England and was now accompanied by his pregnant wife, Elizabeth, his son, Giles, and daughters, Constance and Damaris, along with 2 servants, Edward Doty and Edward Lester. In addition to the Mullinses, Eatons, and Billingtons, whom Bradford later called one of the profanest families amongst them, there were 4 children from Shipton, Shropshire. Ellen, Jasper, Richard, and Mary Moore were the products of an adulterous relationship between their mother, Catherine Moore, and her longtime lover, Jacob Blakeway. When Catherine's husband, Samuel Moore, an aristocrat who spent most of his time in London, belatedly realized that his children were not his own, their resemblance to Blakeway, he insisted in court, was unmistakable, he divorced his wife and took custody of the children. Moore determined that it would be best for the children to begin a new life in America. They were sent to London and placed under the care of Weston, Cushman, and Carver, who assigned Ellen, 8, to Edward and Elizabeth Winslow, Jasper, 7, to the Carvers, and both Richard, 5, and Mary, 4, to William and Mary Brewster, who were accompanied by their evocatively named sons, Love and Wrestling. In the meantime, matters were coming to a head between the Leideners and Thomas Weston. Cushman had signed the revised agreement with the merchants in London, but the Leideners refused to honor it. Weston stalked off in a huff, insisting that they must then look to stand on their own legs. As Cushman knew better than anyone, this was not in their best interests. They didn't have enough provisions to feed them all for a year, and yet they still owed many of their suppliers money. Without Weston to provide them with the necessary funds, they were forced to sell off some